I'd like to talk about two incidents that happened between China and the United States over the last several months as a way to get into three topics today. And those two incidents involved Chinese officials, in one case a Chinese senior police official, and in the other case a Chinese human rights lawyer seeking some type of asylum at American diplomatic stations in China. And I wanted to use these two events, which first happened in February, the last happened actually just a couple months ago, these two events as a way to talk about three topics relating to China. The first is that my belief is that these events really underscore the idea that we need to begin to doubt a narrative that has been being built up over the last decade, that China somehow is going to become the great superpower and is going to take over the world. While I totally agree with Chris Hill that China is going to be around for a long time, for sure, but many of us have this idea, uh-oh, the Chinese are coming and everything's finished and we're going to lose and, you know, the world's going to fall apart. It's not the case. And I think these two events underscore that. They underscore some of China's very, very deep challenges that it's going to be confronted with over the next few years. The second issue is that from 1989, from the Tiananmen Square crackdown until today, China has enjoyed 22 years of a lack of political instability. And that is unique. It's the longest period of political stability China has enjoyed since the 1840s. And this incident, these incidents, I clearly show that that period is potentially ending, and that politics is now going to raise its head in China again and could cause some instability in the future, which will affect China's growth model and that those graphs that always seem to go up when it comes to China. And the final issue I think these incidents show is the really, really central place that the United States plays within the psyche of the Chinese. It is something that a lot of Americans don't understand. But, for example, when Jeremy Lin hit the court in Madison Square Garden, China went bananas. But it's not just Jeremy Lin. It's Michael Jordan. It's LeBron for the NBA. And it's any trend that's happening in the United States is picked up in China almost immediately. The United States occupies this huge position within the Chinese worldview, and I think it's important to remember that as Americans. And it complicates America's task of trying to forge, as Steve talked about, an intelligent relationship with China. So let's talk about these two events, sort of what happened. Some of you might have read them in the newspaper, but for those of you who haven't, I'll sort of go over them. The first event I want to talk about is in February, a fellow by the name of Wang Lijun, who was a senior security official in the Chinese apparatus, state security apparatus, showed up in front of the U.S. consulate in Chengdu, which is the westernmost consulate the United States has in China. He's 200 miles away from his base in Chongqing. It used to be pronounced Chengqing. It was the World War II wartime capital the Chinese had. He shows up at the American consulate there and basically knocks on the door and asks to be let in. And they let him in, and he asks for some type of political asylum, not necessarily for political asylum, but for some type of protection. And this is unusual because, you know, Wang Lijun is a cop from a security system that doesn't have the best of relations with the United States. That he would come to us, I think, illustrates something very deep about how Chinese look at America. We almost always seem to be the place they go, even cops, as a last resort. What the United States did at that moment was they quickly determined in the State Department that what he had to offer did not involve national security. So they couldn't grant him, or they didn't grant him, any type of asylum. And then what they did next was fascinating. When he showed up at the consulate, a series of Chinese police vans had been following him, found him, and surrounded the consulate. Those were police vans and police organs from Chongqing, from the place he fled from. But the Americans contacted the central government. The central government dispatched a senior official in the Ministry of State Security, who then took him back to Beijing. That action did two things. One, it most probably saved Wang Lijun's life. Because if he had fallen back into the hands of his colleagues from Chongqing, there's no doubt he would have faced a tragic car accident on the way home. But the second thing it did, it gave Beijing the excuse it needed to go after Wang Lijun's boss, this fellow by the name of Bo Xilai, who was the party secretary in Chongqing. Chongqing is, for those of you who haven't been there, the biggest city in the world. It has 36 million people in it. Large place. Almost five times the size of New York City, but who's counting? But Wang Lijun had a story to tell, and the story he had told was about massive corruption in Chongqing and also about the murder of a British businessman, apparently carried out by Bo Xilai's wife, a huge scandal, and also about the potential taping, secret taping, sort of a la the Nixon tapes, that Bo Xilai was carrying out of some of China's leaders. And equipped with that story, Party Central moved against Bo Xilai, purged him, and then launched basically China's most serious political crisis since 1989. What this story illustrates is that the system of China's government is as potentially unstable as it's always been. And sort of going back in history a little bit, what we need to remember is that from 1949 on, from China's Communist Revolution on, the main source of instability in China's history from 49 on has been the Communist Party. So in 1956, the Communist Party, Chairman Mao, launched the anti-rightist campaign, in which basically hundreds of thousands of people who had studied overseas, many in the United States, who had come back as patriotic Chinese to build their country, were purged, sent to labor camps, lost their jobs, and spent the rest of their lives basically under this dark cloud of being considered having a bad class background. Several years after that, the party launched the Great Leap Forward, which was this sort of insane economic policy that they wanted to surpass England and catch up to America by turning everyone's backyard into a steel furnace. It didn't work. 30 million people died of starvation. 6 years after that, the party launched the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution, which again ruined or seriously hampered the lives of some 18 million Chinese young people who were sent from the cities down to the countryside without any education, often for a decade at a time, to learn from Chinese peasantry. Many of those people have yet to succeed to return to the cities from where they grew up. And another 650,000 people were killed in political struggles. Fast forward again to 1989, again a party-caused crisis, where the party, because it could not figure out how it wanted to deal with these student protests, ultimately decided to attack it, killing hundreds of people on the streets of Beijing. The Wang and Bo case, to my mind, illustrates that this system is still very much in existence, and its potential for instability is still very high. And to sort of draw a little comparison with one of China's other great Asian neighbors, India. We pretty much know what India is going to look like in 20 years. It's going to be a big lumbering democracy, a big bureaucratic democracy, a somewhat corrupt democracy. But as long as it doesn't engage in a nuclear holocaust with Pakistan, it's going to be pretty much the same. It's going to be very similar to what it is today. We have no idea what China's going to look like in two decades. And it's because of their very unstable political system that we don't have answers to that question. And I think that the Wang and the Bo case illustrate that quite clearly. Already, the Wang and the Bo case have had consequences in China. It's clearly delayed the political transition that China is in the midst of. The 18th meeting of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of China has been postponed. It's probably going to be pushed from the fall, perhaps to the late fall or to the early winter. It's unclear now whether the Standing Committee of the Politburo, which are the small group of men, and they're all men, who rule China, will contain the current 9, will drop to 7, or move to 11. 11 is a soccer team, and the Chinese soccer is not very good, so it's very difficult for those people to work together. That's, whereas 7 is okay, 5 is basketball. Chinese basketball is good. They might be able to work better together. But this shows that already the political problem of this purge is affecting the structure. In addition, China has moved uncharacteristically slowly to deal with its economic slowdown. It was clear in February when the Wang and Bo case blew blew up, that China's economy was slowing down. The Communist Party waited until April or May. It's quite slow for them to deal with it. Now they've loosened bank rules. They're pumping more money into the economic system, but the slowness is probably a result, according to most economists, to the fact that the party was reeling from this economic political problem. Another reason that the story bodes badly, I think, for China is that while the premier and the president of China were happy to see Bo Xilai purged, his economic model, which is a very different economic model from that of Deng Xiaoping and Premier Zhu Rongji from the 1990s, which pushed private enterprise, his economic model, which was giving lots of money to state-owned companies, funneling money into large infrastructure projects, de-emphasizing money for private companies, which are really the engine of economic growth in China, is a model that's been accepted nationwide. And unless the Communist Party re-embraces its reforms from the 80s and the early 90s, the country's economic growth model is going to be in for serious trouble. And why do I say that? So let me sort of talk about several reasons why, again, that this incident underscores some of China's long-term weaknesses. The first issue that China's facing is a demographic challenge. So in the West, we have this idea of China as this country of limitless labor. You know, they've stolen all our jobs, and they're working for 2 cents a day. Well, Chinese labor costs are going up every year by at least 11%. And for the export industry, where their margins are quite small, like sometimes like as low as 2%, an 11% jump in your labor costs on a year-end, year-on basis is going to hurt your bottom line significantly. And the reason why China's demographics are difficult, of course, is the one-child policy. It's a society that's aging much more rapidly than the United States. So in 15 years, they're going to have a higher percentage of their people above the age of 60 than we will in America. In a decade, they're going to have 100 million people over the age of 80. And they're doing that in a country that is yet to get rich. And that huge demographic time bomb that they're facing is not going to be helped by an economic model which pushes all the money to state-owned companies, which are very inefficient. The other issue is worsening food security. China is urbanizing more rapidly than any society on Earth. When I first went to China in 1980, it was about 70% rural, 30% urban. Today, it's 50-50. That means half the population now lives in the cities, half of 1.4 billion people. In the next 15 to 20 years, they want to move another 300 million people into cities. Doing so is taking up a large amount of agricultural farmland. And the Chinese hurt themselves because they believe that food security is part of national security. And so certain things like corn statistics are state secrets. Now, welcome to Chicago, right? So that has a tendency to enrich the farming man, the Iowa corn farmers. Because when China doesn't release its corn needs, it's almost always buying at the highest possible price. And by taking these, and again, by not privatizing this stuff, not understanding that they have to totally embrace the market on these issues, they're hurting themselves. In addition to those, there's nationwide environmental problems, which you've no doubt read about. And the other issue are nationwide health problems in a country that is just beginning to put together a social safety net. A friend of mine at the National Institute of Health, once we were having dinner together, and he said, I'll give you two words why China will never become a superpower. And I'm like, what, sort of social trust, whatever. And he said, no, lung cancer. They have 300 million smokers in China. And 10% of the state's revenue comes from cigarette taxes. And so the state, because it's gaining so much money from this cash cow, is reluctant to really launch full bore into an anti-smoking campaign. So that's sort of some of China's issues. Now let me talk about the second incident that happened at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing, where the man known in the United States as the blind lawyer, because none of us can pronounce his name, Cheng Guangcheng, came to the Americans. He basically sneaked out of Shandong, province and came into the arms of American diplomats who housed him for a while before they negotiated his release from China, where he's now at New York University. So what's the background to this? So Chen was a local self-taught legal person. He became a lawyer. And he fought China's system by taking the state to court for what he believed were illegal forced abortions and forced sterilizations, representing people from his village and from his county. And so for those crimes, he was then thrown into jail for a variety of trumped-up charges. He was released from jail in September of 2010. But from the moment he was released, he was basically back in jail. The people in his village, the public security people in his village, paid village thugs to keep him locked up. They beat him. They beat his wife. They terrorized his child. He was effectively under not just house arrest, but sort of house jail from September 2010 up until the point that he, a blind man, escaped from the clutches of these characters in the dark of the night. What his case to me, because I was in Beijing while all this was happening, what really struck me about this case is not the treatment that he received from the blunt end of the stick of the Chinese security services. It was the reactions of my Chinese friends to what happened to him. A decade ago, when I was a bureau chief in Beijing, most of my Chinese friends, when these type of human rights cases popped up, were like, that guy's just in the way of me. I'm just trying to make a lot of money. You know, you foreigners are all crazy about human rights. Just shut up. I got some property deals to do with. This time, it was, and on several occasions, I was corrected by my Chinese friends who said, he's not a dissident. Dissident in Chinese is sort of a bad word. They said, he's not a dissident. He's a human rights lawyer. As if to say, I can relate to this guy. And one of the reasons they can relate to him is that the need for a legal system that is predictable is rising as China's economy becomes more and more complex. As more individual Chinese businessmen, entrepreneurs, want to innovate, they want to create things, they want to and have those innovations protected, they want to have patents. And they have begun to view people like Chen, who's out there battling for the little guy, as someone who very well could be them or battling for them in the future. And I found that switch to be, now obviously I'm just one guy talking with people, but among the same people who a decade ago were flying high on China's growth model are now questioning that and saying, you know, we need to become more predictable. We need to have a legal system that's not basically just simply working for the Communist Party, but also representing all of us if we're actually going to become a 21st century economy. Now, the third issue I'd like to talk about is what these two cases illustrate about relations between the United States and China. And I think we, you know, as Americans, when we look at China, we have this whole very, very deep, very historical sense of China is our friend. We always had warm feelings about China. At the same time, we also have been taught to think that we've done a lot of bad things in China, therefore we should continue helping them. And I think it's important for us as Americans to understand that China's rise from the 1970s, 80s, 90s until today was significantly helped by the United States. And that if not the main, we were at least one of the main enablers of China's modernization. From the beginning, our open universities, our open markets, and our open society enabled the Chinese to grasp the necessity for economic reform, make an enormous amount of money, and create this incredible economic juggernaut that they've created today. The Chinese understand that in their very much in their hearts. They don't acknowledge it. The Communist Party doesn't acknowledge it. But that's the reality of the relationship. The United States has nothing to apologize when it comes to dealing with China. And I think that the incidence of seeing both a senior police official and a human rights lawyer running to the United States as the last resort, I think clearly illustrates that the Chinese look at the United States and hold the United States. They often put the United States on this pedestal that Americans are uncomfortable being on. They look to us as the place of last resort, and I think those cases illustrate that very clearly. American cultural penetration in China is enormous, and for sort of just a couple of things like Kung Fu Panda, Mulan and Karate Kid 2, When those movies came out in China, the Chinese were sort of dumbfounded, shocked and amazed at, you know, how can you take our stories and tell them so well? If you go to a Chinese, the office of any Chinese person who has almost who has anything to do with foreigners or foreign travel, invariably in that office, in the pride of place in that office, you will find large vats of Kirkland brand vitamins, which their friends have purchased for them at Costco. Fish oil. Even though the precursors for most of those vitamins are all made in China, the Chinese still want the American brand. And so I think that Americans need to understand of how what in a sense what a high opinion they have of the United States. At the same time, and this is the schizophrenic part of it, the political correctness within the Communist Party demands that the Chinese in the party internally refer to America as the enemy. And that creates real complications for them as a political organization in the country and as people. Because while one fellow could be writing an internal report, the enemy, the American enemies are trying to constrain China and keep us down and they love Taiwan and doing that. At the same time, he's trying to get his daughter into Harvard or Stanford or Whiteman, as we just heard about the kids. No doubt those kids have lots of money too. And so on a personal level, they're very pro-American. But on an internal political level, they have to be anti-American. At the same time, they hold the United States. They demand so much from the United States. They want us to be, you know, their great beacon, their great model. That is an enormous problem for people like Chris Hill and his successors who are trying to fashion a logical and successful American policy towards China. And I think these two cases illustrate it. Now, in these two cases, as luck would have it, the American government actually handled them quite well. They handed Wang Lujin to the Chinese authorities. Okay, he didn't get political asylum, but as a top cop in China who'd been torturing people for several decades, he probably didn't deserve it. They no doubt saved his life, one would imagine. At the same time, they also facilitated the purging of somebody who was a competitor to the central government in Beijing. And with the blind lawyer, Cheng Guangcheng, his release was negotiated. The Chinese might have felt a slight loss of face, but in the end of the day, it came out quite successfully. The interesting thing also is it's not just blind lawyers and Chinese cops who run into the United States. And I don't know whether this repeats something that Ambassador Hill said, but if you look across Asia, all of the Asian countries are coming to the United States for help, not necessarily, protection, possibly, support, definitely, as China grows. Vietnam is the clearest example. This is a country with which we fought a very nasty war. Our relations with Vietnam are not driven by, but they've definitely been pushed by Vietnam's significant and very real concerns about what China wants to do in the South China Sea. The Americans are willing partners there. The Huey helicopters that we left behind are all flying now. We've supplied the Vietnamese with spare parts. We're providing the Vietnamese now with sonar equipment so that their naval vessels can track Chinese submarines. Do you think they'd be sharing the intelligence with the United States Navy? Perhaps. The Philippines, which kicked us out of Clark Air Force Base and Subic Naval Base, now want us back. We're not going, but it's a clear sign that their concerns about China are pushing them back into the arms of the United States. South Korea has the closest relationship it's had with America in decades. The Chinese missteps with Japan. So several years ago, 2 years ago, Japan had a historic election in which, for the first time in about 50-some-odd years, an opposition party beat the Liberal Democratic Party. And this opposition party, the Japanese Democratic Party, was sort of a party of what I guess you could call them peaceniks. The wife of the prime minister believed in the sun god. The prime minister in the 60s used to wear a peace symbol. And they viewed themselves as a political organization that wanted to be sort of in between America and China. The Chinese welcomed that election by dispatching a People's Liberation Army naval unit through Japanese territorial waters. They buzzed the Japanese Self-Defense Forces ship with a helicopter with their machine guns trained on that ship with lasers. again, the results of the Japanese and this Japanese Democratic Party is now closer to the United States than American diplomats would ever believe. And so it's not simply the Chinese that sort of want to rely on the United States to help them to confront, not necessarily, but to manage, deal with China's rise. It's Asia as well. Australia, as an example, Indonesia too, Thailand when it has the need. So again, with that, I'd like to end. I'm not going to talk for 90 minutes. I think that was false advertising on my part. I'd like to get into your questions, which is really sort of the funnest part of the show. But thank you very much for your time.
While we're gathering the questions, allow me to kind of kick it off with a question or two. John, you talked about the legal system needing to, at some point, provide the kinds of institutional bases to support the economic model in China. Take it a little bit beyond that particular institution. What are the other institutions, and what's the time frame that one can really begin to look to so that, you know, what are the Chinese thinking about? Do they believe that there are other institutional needs that they must address? And are they starting to do that? What's the time frame for that?
A perfect alternative example is food safety. So not a day doesn't go by if we're having Chinese friends over for dinner or we're not talking about food safety. I get my vegetables in Beijing from a farmer I know because I don't trust the vegetables you buy in the market. I get my meat from a German butcher who basically controls the whole production train from the pig down to the hot dog or from the cow from the hot dog. But their food safety structure is, again, an institution that is deeply in need of help. One, they don't have enough people. Two, they don't have the expertise. And three, because of the breakdown of values in the society, they have a lot of farmers who are willing to put melamine in the milk. You've read about the melamine milk scandal. Poisons in the toothpaste. Huge amounts of hormones in the meat in order to increase profits. For example, the Chinese national team, which is going to be in London in a couple of days, is not allowed to eat in any restaurant in China at all. They only can eat food that is controlled by the Chinese national sports bureaucracy because of their concerns of testing positive for hormones and for other types of steroids. Go figure. So again, this is an issue that the institutions that China is creating or trying to create are woefully lagging behind the complexity of their economy.
Last week, Ambassador Hill talked about North Korea from the U.S. and South Korean perspective. What does China think of North Korea, its new leadership, and its nuclear program?
I think two main issues. First, it's a giant pain in the ass for China. It's an enormous problem for them. At the same time, their interests in China are really fundamentally different than our interests. So basically, interest number 1 through 99 from the Chinese perspective is stability in North Korea. They do not want regime collapse. Interest number 100 is get the nukes out. But 1 through 99, why don't they want regime collapse? They view North Korea, and I think, understandably, as their East Germany. And if that wall comes down, not only do they have 250,000 refugees, but they have the beginnings, from their perspective, of potential systemic collapse in China. This is a domestic political issue as far as they're concerned. Historically, China has always had huge sway on the Korean Peninsula until the Japanese pushed them out in 1895. And so they look at this peninsula as kind of theirs. And the situation they have had for a long period of time with good relations with the North and a strong economic relations with the South would be shattered. If there's collapse, and it's united under South Korea, it will be united under a government that knows China opposes the unification of South Korea, of the Korean Peninsula. In addition, the Chinese also have a large population of Korean Chinese. And the Koreans, once they're united, that nationalism will not stop at China's border. It's going to spread. And so for them, there was potential downside or enormous. And so their interests really are fundamentally different than ours.
We hear about China owning a large percent of our debt. Can you characterize this ownership? Citizens, companies, investment funds, the Chinese government, and also speak to what you think is sort of the strategic impact of that debt ownership.
It's the government which owns the debt. You don't see too many Chinese clipping coupons. But it's basically a government decision, and the decision is made in order to keep the value of China's currency pretty much stable. Closely related to the dollar. And they've made that decision because they believe so strongly that China's exports need to be affordable for the American consumer, because underneath a lot, we are a significant driver. We, the people who make decisions at Walmart and Toys R Us or wherever every day, are a significant driver of China's economy. The strategic implications, does it give China a lever over the United States? Well, you know the whole kind of the joke, if I owe you $1,000, you know, I'm in hock to you, but if I owe you $10 billion, you know, you're in hock to me. And I think that from a geopolitical perspective, that's really what we should look at. China's not, I mean, if China begins to dump its treasuries, the value of the treasuries will collapse so quickly that it's going to be stuck holding a bag, and that's not going to happen. And secondly, our economic health, they understand, is deeply, deeply intertwined in their success. And they have a stake in our success, even though internally they want to make us the enemy. They know that actually at the end of the day we're not.
Can you comment on Russia and China's veto of Syrian sanctions? I think it was it today in the United Nations?
Yesterday. So on this game, the Russians are taking the lead. And the Russians have generally taken the lead on issues like this in the Security Council. China, in several cases, has not been Russia's partner on this on issues and gone or abstained or voted with the United States. But on the Syria issue, the Chinese are very much Russia's friend. And I think it's more a tit for tat. I think the Chinese are doing this to show support for Russia, not so much because intrinsically they believe in the maintenance of the Assad regime. The Chinese interests in Syria are not that significant, other than arms sales. Their interests in Iran, however, are significant. And so their potential is that they're doing this both to help Iran and to help the Russians. I think it's quite clear. Especially because, from their view, one could argue that they owe the Iranians a favor. Because of American pressure, the Chinese have decreased their oil investments and their oil purchases from Iran. This might be China's way of giving back to their friends in Tehran.
Can you comment on ethnic issues in China?
So by ethnic issues, I guess the question is about the Tibetans and maybe about the other restive minority, the Uyghurs, which are a Turkic, generally Islamic-leading minority in China's northwest. So 95% of China's population is Han Chinese, and only 5% are ethnic minorities. But those 5% occupy about 40% of China's landmass. So Tibet is enormous, and Xinjiang is enormous as well. And so the Chinese policy towards these areas has been to, as much as possible, populate them with Chinese. And you know, Americans are like, oh my God, I can't believe you're populating Tibet with Chinese. At the same time, well, you know, how did the United States grow? We populated the West too. It's not necessarily equal, but there is an analogy. A while back, actually, the State Department was running tours for Chinese ethnic minority officials to American Native American reservations, and I don't know if that's necessarily the model. It was sort of a bizarre thing, but I think it's been stopped now. But those relationships are restive, and the Chinese have not won much love in either Tibet or in Xinjiang. And the Dalai Lama issue is, you know, the man is becoming elderly. And when he passes away and moves on to the next life, you know, with the Buddhist reincarnation, there are probably going to be two new Dalai Lamas. And the Chinese will have one, and the exile community will have one. And then one expects the Tibetan Youth Congress, which is much more radical, they're based in India, to begin potentially violence in Lhasa and elsewhere in Tibet, which would not be a good direction. So most people have come to the conclusion that the Chinese should negotiate with the Dalai Lama. The Chinese won't. Their policy is to let the old man die. And I think ultimately they're going to reap the whirlwind in a violent reaction. But again, making these type of politically difficult decisions is difficult in their structure, the way it's organized. They have seven men having to make one decision, and everyone is watching for the knife in their back.
John, we've had several questions that speak to the question of the environment in China. Obviously, the way in which they produce energy, the issue of water, the impact on health. Can you speak to those areas?
So I don't know if any people are aware about the United States EPA little weather station inside the compound of the Beijing embassy. And every day, actually several times a day, the U.S. embassy sends out tweets talking about the 2.5 micron particulate matter in the air. And the tweets are invariably much higher than the Chinese EPA statistics about that day's weather in Beijing. And I remember on one day, the U.S. Embassy came out with their number was about 280 to 300, which is like considered not just unhealthy, but like downright bad for you. And the Chinese were like, today is a good weather day. And so the foreign ministry has come out with a statement saying, you know, stop these tweets, you're interfering in the internal affairs of our country. And the U.S. Embassy, bless its heart, continues to pump out the particulate matter. That said, the Chinese are aware that their environment is horrible. And they're trying to take steps to create a cleaner environment. And they're taking aggressive steps to own the clean energy business. They've put enormous amount of investment in that. Their problem, though, is innovation. And that's not just a clean energy problem. It's also a problem society-wide. Think Kung Fu Panda, think Mulan, think Karate Kid 2. It's innovation. And so while they're putting an enormous amount of money into solar, into different types of nuclear technology, into wind technology, into coal gasification that was actually developed in America, they've yet to really make any significant breakthroughs. And partially is because most of this money is being funneled through state-owned companies, which don't have the flexibility to take on and to actually innovate like some of their smaller private companies would. Now, if that begins to change in China, I think the Chinese are set for a revolution in technology, because the other factor the Chinese have is scalability. If they succeed, something can be scaled up in China very fast. They got a market of 1.4 billion people. And if something takes off, it can really take off well. So it's a horrible environment. They understand their problems. The techniques they're taking to deal with them are troublesome. But if they change those techniques, they actually could be quite successful. And there's a huge potential for marriage between American technology and Chinese know-how that could be beneficial for both countries.
How separate is Hong Kong from the central government business regulation, and is Taiwan a big issue or concern any longer?
Let me take the Taiwan issue first, and then I'll go into Hong Kong second. The Taiwan issue actually is another example of where the United States and China have actually managed a problem relatively well. So historically, we have strong historical ties to the Republic of China and Taiwan. We sell them weapons every couple of years. The Chinese scream and yell every couple of years. But when there's a problem in Taiwan, as there was with the previous president, Chen Shui-bian, who was really pushing and doing things unnecessarily that would unnecessarily irritate Beijing, the United States, to the extent it could, put its foot on his neck and said, stop messing around. At one point, George W. Bush, the presence of Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao, criticized Chen, which gave the Premier enormous face in China and put the Taiwanese authorities on notice that pushing independence is not going to be a smart thing. At the same time, now that there's a president in Taiwan who understands the necessity of a good relationship with the mainland, at the same time wants to bolster what little sovereignty Taiwan has left, the Americans are supportive of him. And I think the Americans have actually played a pretty smart game, is that in that the problem effectively with China's international relations is no longer Taiwan, it's now in the South China Sea. And I think it's partially because both countries have handled this, what could be an explosive problem, pretty well. As for Hong Kong, Hong Kong's owned by the Communist Party of China. And it's important to understand that any political development in Hong Kong happens with the okay of the Mandarins in Beijing. That said, Hong Kong's judicial system is still very much separate from its political system. And so as an entrepot into China, as a place where foreign companies can go for a free and fair judicial system, it's enormously important. And the Chinese, since 1997, when they took it back from the British, have not messed with it that much. And I think that's a testimony to their intelligence that understand the importance of Hong Kong to China's development, especially to southern China's development, because it's crucial there.
What effect will China's hoarding of natural resources in Africa and South America have on our and the world economy? And also speak to what's the reality. Is there hoarding or isn't there?
I mean, for any product, there's an international market. And so for iron ore, et cetera, for copper, it's an international market. And the Chinese really are not stockpiling these things and keeping them in China. In order for them to hold on to them, to sell them later on to you at a high price. That said, the Chinese, the arrival of China on the scene as a consumer of oil, they started importing oil about 15 years ago, as a huge consumer of iron ore for their steel industry, as an enormous consumer of copper for all their wireless communications, has created a huge bubble in these type of prices. Soybeans, for example. Brazil, Argentina, Australia, and America are all enormous beneficiaries from China's increased soybean appetite. China's iron ore appetite has powered the economic development of Australia, Brazil, and parts of Africa as well. So in general, my sense is that it's been beneficial to the world economy in that prices have gone up. More mining's happened, more of these things have been extracted from Earth, more people have made money from it. We don't want China's economy to fall apart. It's an enormous driver of the global economy. So I think all in all, it's not hoarding so much. It's that China, as a country that really didn't do any economic development from 1949 to 1970, is now trying to catch up. They're trying to compress our industrial revolution of 200 years into 40. And in doing so, they need a lot of stuff. And living in China now, with their high-speed trains, their amazing new airports, it's remarkable what they've done in the span of just a couple of decades.
Let's turn to politics. Can you describe the Chinese Politburo, the politics that result in membership? And then, as the writer says, where do these men come from?
For many, many years, from the 1990s up until this group, the group of seven now, the only people who could get on the Politburo basically were engineers. China was a country run for the last 15-some-odd years by engineers. Now they have a lawyer on there for the first time. Oh, my God, it's all going to go downhill from there. And so they're beginning to bring people in from the humanities a bit more to begin to manage some of the what they understand to be the difficulties of their rise. Now, how do you get onto the Politburo? Well, you first of all, you can't make a mistake, which is very difficult within the Chinese political system. Second of all, you probably have to have a rabbi, some type of mentor, to bring you up. You have to have something. And usually you need at least three or four, because your rabbi might get purged, so you need to have as many people to help you out as you move up. Thirdly, you have to have some foreign experience now, but you can't have too much, because those people are still considered, even like they are in this country, suspect. If you can speak French, you're a problem. Although that said, at the vice ministerial level, within the Chinese government, most of those men and women have had significant experience in this country now, whereas their bosses haven't. And I think that's a generational change you're going to see happen over the next 10 to 20 years. For example, the fellow who's supposed to be China's next president spent a long time in Iowa, not a long time, several months in the 1980s. I'll tell you, as an aside, just a sort of interesting story about him. When he came back to the United States earlier this year on his trip before he becomes the top boss, sort of a get-to-know-you trip. It was an exchange. Biden went to China, so as the vice president, he came to our country. And he went back to Iowa to meet some of the people he knew in 85. And when he came there, he said this time, you know, there was something I didn't understand about you Americans when I came. He said, you know, you all had dogs as pets. And I thought that was totally bizarre. He said, I understand that now. He said, I have a dog. In fact, I have two dogs. And of all the comments he made in the United States, only those comments were not reported back in China. Why? Having a pet in China, which everybody, not everybody, but many people do have now, is still considered bourgeois, right? Like a political problem. And in Beijing, if you have a dog, you can only have one. So not only was the guy a bourgeois, but he was a lying, cheating, stealing bourgeois. So the Xinhua News Agency censored that from his thing. So that said, he seems to have more of a personality than President Hu, which I think ultimately is not a bad thing. They're sort of estranged, but he was married to a songbird, a singer, and in a conversation he had with Ambassador Rant, he went on and on and on about how much he liked American Westerns, because there's a clear definition between right and wrong. I think he's talking about John Wayne and not some of the Blazing Saddles for that thing. Well, especially the bean scene, right?
Going from the one dog policy to the one child policy, the aging of the Chinese population is clearly aggravated by the one child policy.
Yeah.
Is there any sign of a change in the future?
That, again, gets into the question of making a difficult but necessary political decision. You talk to any demographer in China, and they're all working for government think tanks, and they're all like, we got to change this. This is a crazy rule. The population of Shanghai is falling. I mean, the only way it's bolstered is because they keep on bringing people in from the countryside to do, you know, they're basically, the people from the countryside are China's illegal immigrants, right? They do all the grunt work. And the only way Shanghai can support itself is if it brings people in from the outside. Because the population of the people who live in Shanghai, everyone in Shanghai is only having one child and no one's interested in having two. So the demographers understand that China has got to get out of this bind. It's got to start allowing its people to have more than one child. So every 6 months or so, a senior Chinese demographer or an economist will get up and say, the one-child policy is nuts, we got to change it. 2 days later, the family planning people will get up and say, no change. It shows that there's a very active debate. So there already are some tweaks to the policy. So if you're an only child and he or she's an only child, you can have two kids. If in the countryside, if your first son, your first child is a girl, you can have another child. And that creates this huge issue, though, it has unintended consequences for sex-selective abortions, where, you know, the great ultrasound technology is being used to push ancient Chinese cultural traditions of favoring boys over girls. And so in some provinces like Guangxi, for example, in southern China, you have for every 127 boys under the age of six, you have 100 girls. It's like skewed. It's this very skewed gender relation balance. So they know they have to change it, but again, it's a significantly sensitive political decision for them to take, and they're cutting around the margins. And a lot of demographers don't think that's going to be good enough.
Okay, our questioner says, I've read that wealth and certain levels of Chinese society leads to things such as animal rights activism. What other types of awareness of social responsibility has come out of China's economic success?
You name it, they got it. So just off the top of my head, lot of environmental activism, a lot of specifically middle-class people, upper-middle-class people banding together against the petrochemical plant that's being built outside the condo, and actually in some cases succeeding in getting the petrochemical plant stopped. Fights against dams. Recently in Shanghai, there's been this whole issue of the women in Shanghai, the young women in Shanghai, like to wear very scanty clothes. And they like to take the subway in their very scanty clothes. And the subways in China are crowded. And so it creates huge possibilities for gropers to grope. And so the women have banded together and gone on China's internet, sort of their version of Twitter, and thousands of them are tweeting about, I was grabbed, I was fondled at this station at this time, and basically putting pressure on the authorities to crack down on groping. And the authorities came back and said, you should wear more clothes. at which point, several Chinese women got into an abaya, and took photographs of themselves and saying, is this enough? And putting them up on Twitter. And so this is just an example of the activism that's throughout China's urban middle class, which at 100 million to 200 million is not a huge percentage of the population, but it's growing quickly. And these type of things, especially when they're done with humor, have a great deal of resonance in the society. Because the Communist Party, like most governments, does not like humor.
Okay, final question. There are always a lot of stories of censorship and monitoring of foreigners. Have you had any scary or funny moments involving government agents keeping an eye on you or your work or your family?
I worked as a journalist, a resident journalist in China twice. So I went there in 88 as the low guy on the AP totem pole. And and I covered the Tiananmen Square crackdown. And at the end of that crackdown, a couple weeks after the crackdown, in middle June 1989, I got a phone call. I was at the AP Bureau. The U.S. Embassy had just reopened that day. I got a phone call from the public security people saying, this is the public security for foreigners. We order you immediately to come down to our station house. We want to talk to you. And I got a consular official from the embassy, went down. They denied her access. And for the next 6 hours, I was interrogated about my crimes that I committed over the course of the Tiananmen Square demonstrations. And at the end of this interrogation, they were very focused on a relationship I'd had with a military officer. They basically sort of said, you're both unfriendly and uncooperative, and they expelled me from the country. And I thought at that time that, you know, I'll never be able to come back to China again. They gave me 3 days to leave. And they, in an exhibition that they had on the Tiananmen Square crackdown, I had a very large photograph of me as one of the black hands behind the rebellion. And I wasn't really scared for my physical security. They've done that to other people, luckily not to me. They beat an ABC correspondent so badly, actually, that he still literally can't stand up for more than a half an hour at a time. But that said, I joined the Post, and luckily Mrs. Catherine Graham was on my side, and she used her substantial leverage to get me back in. And when I got back in, I really had the sense among my contacts in the foreign ministry that, you know, if you don't have a fight, you really don't understand each other when it comes to the Chinese. And so from 98 to 2003, we had a lot of problems with the security services. But I was always incredibly open in my emails, talking on the telephone, talking on my cell, anything about what I was doing. I never, except if it had to do with Falun Gong, the banned Chinese, in which we used our own, we used SIM cards that we bought at a railroad station that were untrackable, and did a lot, and used other type of encrypted email in order to protect them. But when it had to do anything else to that, I was always completely open about what I was doing. Because I was monitored, it was clear. We were followed sometimes. We were yelled at on a regular basis. But I thought that if I can be as completely open and give them no surprises, then they could do very little to me. And the last thing in the world they wanted to do was kick out a Washington Post reporter. It didn't make any sense. So I knew I had flexibility, but at the same time, I also had a sense of, okay, these guys are on me, fine. Let them know what you're doing. Because it's when they don't know where you are that they get nervous, and they start doing really bad stuff. That said, do I want to be a reporter again in China now? I don't know. Because the country has changed. It's become a lot more aggressive. They've just kicked out an American who worked for Al Jazeera. They're threatening people with revoking visas, all sorts of shenanigans that they didn't do that now. And my wife's a Chinese national. Would they go after her now? 10 years ago when we were first married, I didn't imagine them going after her. Now, I don't know. And that's an issue that I have to factor into. As the central government, the top of the central government, the political Politburo becomes weaker, the bureaucracy becomes stronger, the security services have the biggest budget in the country. It surpasses the military budget. And those guys are running the show now. And the way they treat foreigners, I think, is an indication of how they're treating their people. And so I would be more reluctant to deal with them now. As that decade ago was a lot different place. So I don't want to end on such a negative note, but.
Well, John, thank you so very much for opening your mind to our community, for coming a long way to share your thoughts with us, and helping us be better informed as citizens and as members of this larger global community. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.